Thank you very much, and thank you for your kind introduction. Good evening, everyone. Really nice to be here with you. And I would like to start by thanking my good colleagues, Professor Elisabetta Malaspina, Professor Eduardo Jorge de Oliveira, and of course, Professor Ana Sobral. I'm delighted to be here. I really thank you for reaching out. I think this is exactly what scholars should be doing, having a conversation, which I think also involves the students and the researchers and everyone interested for that matter. I also wanted to say to the students that I think you're very lucky to have this particular configuration of interdisciplinary discussion. We speak all the time about interdisciplinarity amongst ourselves, but it's rare that there's actually a process whereby this is brought together, mixing matters of history, law, English, more generally, I think, social sciences. So this is really a very nice opportunity, and you made me jealous thinking about my own students. Maybe I'll introduce something similar. So this is what I wanted to do this evening with you, and again, thank you very much all for braving the elements and the virus and being here all together. So what I wanted to do with you is a couple of things. I wanted to have this conversation in two or three forms. One is a reflection following this. It's actually by now almost a tetralogy, because I'm starting to work on the fourth volume, which is going to be looking at the... So I went from the event itself, the 9/11 operation, to the organization that led it, to the meaning of political violence, subsequently specifically looking at ISIS, but looking now more at the times we're living. What are the implications for that? What is the grammar of things that we can associate with that? And I'm also doing this, and this is the second level, so I'll focus a bit more on ISIS for you to give you the story and the specific elements, all the time with a reflection on this question of political violence, morphing, transforming, evolving, possibly with a back and forth historically. It's not a completely linear evolution in that sense. But I'm also teaching this semester a new course on the history of the post-9/11 world. And this is a reflection that I wanted to share with you as well, because it came to me as I started thinking about how to write a history of the present. How do we actually write the present? How do we think about it? Most of the contemporary history tends to be a history, say, up until the Cold War or the early 2000s. But it doesn't really have a reflection about what I would call in situ history. History that we live through, that we are actors of, and therefore that we can reflect. Is that actually possible? For the historian, there's always a distance that is needed. But I will argue to you that actually we have now, this particular era, we are in a position where this sort of in-situ reflection, as I call it, is possible in different ways and, in fact, necessary to make sense of that. So I start my reflection, as I said to you, I started my reflection about this some 20 years ago. Next year, actually, will be the 20th anniversary of this, with a reflection about an event that happens, a meta-event, we should call it, in fact, a huge transformative event as such. But that event, which is a terrorist operation, of course, is not just that. It is the sort of the opening salvo to a moment in history. This is what will be called, is being called, already the post-9/11 period. It's not clear exactly what the post-9/11 era is. Is it only the few years after this? Is it about the war on terror? Is it about sort of the next 10 years, the different conflicts, Afghanistan, Iraq? The ISIS story that we'll look on, where do you draw the line? When does the post-Cold War era end and the post-9/11 starts? Are we still in the post-9/11 world? There's a lot to be said about that. What are the markers for that? An event that gives us a snapshot, a series of facts, gives you data, your research, actors, dynamics, histories. I'll come back to those in a moment. But that particular event also was the opening salvo to a policy which went beyond the act itself. It was not a war on terrorism, it was a global war on terrorism. And the term itself was problematic, as I'm sure you have studied and know. Some would say it doesn't make much sense to declare war on terrorism. It's as if you're declaring war on shooting. It's essentially a technique of combat, a strategy, an operation. It's not so clear what that term exactly was when you speak of a certain martiality. And that policy is ongoing. Is it still on? Technically, the term has not been used by the U.S. administration since, by my account, January 2006. The late Bush administration does not use it. It shifts to something which it terms the long war, which becomes the term of art that they refer to. The Obama administration doesn't even use it. They refer to something as overseas contingency operations, kind of a very Obama-esque euphemism kind of sorts, as you can see. And the Trump administration has been using it, but a bit more during the campaign, interestingly, than when in office, as it were. But certainly it's still around. And by the way, this is not a North-South thing. Southern states use the same dynamics with that context. The event, the policy, but that's the plain aspect. 9/11, the post-9/11, and the violence that we're discussing has a much wider relevance for us. It is also about representation all around us. And now we move to what history and language and law connect all together in these manners. This is about representation. This is about interiorization. This is about manifestation, as you can see it in the movies, in cinema, in literature, in the arts. This is an exhibit at the Imperial Museum in London a few years back. And more generally, as a referential, 9/11 has penetrated our lives, our eras, dare I say, our bodies and minds, in a way that is so present around us, that it suffuses this moment in ways that are completely collecting data, literally surveillance, I'll come to that, but also collecting experiences as such. And I think this is why understanding that in a layered way, and therefore to my main point later on, the violence of it is important. Because you do not see the logic of this if you are only in the terrorism narrative, the basic dumbed-down T-word kind of narrative, which is a political narrative for sure, but it is much more than that, because it's been mainstreamed. It's been replayed by the media, we'll get to that. It's been incorporated. It's things that we discussed amongst ourselves, with families, with friends, coffee shops. We have internalized a narrative which, in fact, we don't control. We don't really know much about this story except the basic aspects that will give you a casting. The dangerous, nasty terrorists coming to get the United States check. Yeah, well, they did conduct a terrorist operation, that's obvious. Well, what happens afterwards? How do we get from that to this? How do we get from this to actually that? The symbolism of the decapitation, the castration of the city, and what it means, and so on. Before moving on, I just want to flag, in terms of cinema, I was always struck that when it comes to that era, we have not had that one big, great film. If you think about 9/11 or post-9/11, with Vietnam, we have quite a few. Apocalypse Now comes to mind. The Deer Hunter, or any such sort of big movies, even, you know, Stone's Platoon is not so bad. There's quite a few that try to give you a sense of that experience. And by the way, Apocalypse Now was shot within three or four years, it's 78, 79, 75 is the end of the conflict. We have not had one big novel, too. And this is interesting because there's a plethora of publications, commentary, blogs, and yet when it comes to this issue, we're kind of missing one big statement. And I think that's a non-statement statement, in a way. The fact that we don't have that, we have a multiplicity of sort of small narratives, TV series, a la Homeland, or, you know, any, you know, Netflix kind of quick thriller type thing, Jack Ryan, whatnot, but you do not have one big, intelligent, deep. And by deep, I mean that the Apocalypse Now was based on Conrad's novel, of course, if you know, Heart of Darkness, as we move. So this particular inquiry is very much about trying to make sense of multiplicity, layers, layers into layers. That's what I've been looking at more recently, coming out of this trilogy, to which I'll summarize the key points in a moment. It's an inquiry into all of these things. There's an event and a reaction. It's a phase in international history. It's a moment. How do you sort of delineate that? This is important. We think in terms of decades. Why do we think in terms of decades? The 70s and the 80s and the 90s and the 2000s and the 2010s, which have already ended. We have officially entered a new decade. since 3 months, right? So why do we have that tract of time? Why don't we think in different ways? Can you speak of the 70s in a way that's really accurate, when in fact it's 1967 to 1984? That's the tract of time that would be qualified by those cultural traits that we can look at. This is a series of patterns that we see emerging: security, political, ideological, violence. Series of conflicts, we have quite a few. Afghanistan is the longest conflict in the history of the United States up until now. October 7, 2001, we are already March 2020. It's very strange and difficult for any policymaker in the United States to actually tell you now why is the United States in Afghanistan. In October 2001, we knew why, because Al-Qaeda, which launched the attack on the U.S., was based in Afghanistan. That's the logic of it. But today, it's not clear exactly what's that, and how is that connecting, and how do you keep one thing onto the other all the time. So it's a perceptual moment. I've covered that a few minutes ago. There's a perception about the post-9/11 era, but it's so perceptual that it's almost elusive, almost something that we have a hard time pinning down. As I told you, the class I'm teaching, which is about this, every week I examine how do I actually make this tangible and not merely musings. And I think there's a way to do that that speaks to these issues. The conflicts that I mentioned, Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, Somalia, Yemen, Syria, of course, on and on. And they expand. And they're not just these hotspots, so to speak. A lot of it is about here in the Western metropolis. And I'll get to that. That's my main argument. The Cold War is in and around that. Pre, post, neo-Cold War. You know, when you look at Putin today and Trump, there's a strange sense of neo-Cold War dynamics, although they get along themselves, but in and around, you have the countries acting in very Cold War-ish type of dynamics as such. And all of this is very much about globalization itself. 9/11 is also the period here that we're talking about is about mythology. It's about the beginning of a certain mythology, this absence, presence, that has traumatized one country for sure. It is a U.S. event, but it's not just a U.S. event. It's so global, it's so general, that the dark moment, the shadow of it, of course, very quickly, who to be afraid with in our daily lives, the nasty, dangerous Muslim Arab, right? And beyond that, of course, the notion of constantly carrying this. This absence is carried even when it's not there. And the notion of being sort of in equilibrium in relation to it is central. 9/11 has penetrated the arts, the mindsets, the aesthetics all around us. This is the cover of the Steely Dan, actually the singer of Steely Dan, Donald Fagen. Some of the youngest amongst you may not know this is Californian soft rock from the 70s and 80s. Not bad, actually. I recommend you listen to it. But what it means here is that, and interestingly, Fagan's been thinking about 9/11 in the previous two or three albums, and there's different songs where this appears, as it were. I quote one of them in my book as a very revealing moment. And in the 2011 album here, you clearly see here the condo, sort of think Manhattan condominiums in the back that have been completely swallowed, sunken, as he uses in this imagery, that is almost underwater, almost kind of a mythical Atlantis type of imagery. So this is also about being submerged, immersed, present in this kind of visions as such. And it got me thinking here about the importance of time and the passage of time. This is yours truly on 1995, I think, 1994, I don't even remember. At the top of the Twin Towers, which is a very rare thing at the time. You could go up to the 80th floor, I think, and on a nice day when all the conditions are, if it's not too windy, they would open the top floor and you could go there and you could literally there. And I'm looking at this and I say, yes, I had hair at the time. I've been thinking, this is gone forever. This can never happen again. This thing, this moment in time, not only because of the fall of the towers, but what I mean by that is the passage of time and how do we relate to, how do we reconstruct, how do we write it in terms to give it meaning when you have lived it, not simply writing and researching it, just as you would probably research you, the students, that is, this period, in the same manner that we work on earlier eras as such. So at the heart of this passage of time, we get going onto my main argument, which is fundamentally an argument about representation and language in political bodies. And there, I'm getting now directly into what the book covers, what I would like to share with you, which is a central concern about the nature of the discussion on terrorism, the place ISIS occupies in that debate, and the significance of these constructions. I make an argument in this trilogy, in fact, this culminates, that social sciences have missed, essentially, on this particular challenge. It's a huge challenge that was given to us. This huge event, 9/11, cannot be underestimated as the largest, quantitatively largest attack in history, terrorist attack, about 3,000, 4,000. The numbers aren't clear, but that's way beyond any other attack. And qualitatively, the most powerful group at the time, Al-Qaeda, attacking the most powerful state. So you are qualitatively and quantitatively in a certain sort of zone of history as such. The social sciences have failed in all of the reflections that I've said. I want to be very explicit about that, because I think we have to be tough on ourselves. They have failed to initiate a historically contextualized, not global, not merely Western, or Westernized, for that matter, and nuanced discussion on the phenomenon at hand. I think this lack of a deeper analysis is consequential. What we have had is a ritual of commentary on an international situation. It has solidified. And in spite of being unconvincing to many, many in the population are not convinced by that narrative. But it has been anchored in the matrix which developed after the 9/11 attack, and the replay of this has stayed with us. One of the main reasons for this is what I call here the under-conceptualization, and in the next slide, the under-theorization. They're related, as you can see. But what you have is this kind of impasse, this cul-de-sac in which you do not have the ability to go beyond, because a certain narrative has been presented with a cast of actors, a cast of events, and limited purview. Everything changes after 9/11. Most of these books tell you, no, it's not true. A lot has changed, a lot is transformed, but the history of terrorism is much deeper. It goes beyond. The history of insecurities, in the US including, for that matter, goes beyond. If you're going to bring in the question of the Middle East, it starts way before. If you're going to look at matters of policies and government and authority, where would you start? So this notion that everything changes after is a closing narrative, in fact. It's a narrative in which you give the keys to a certain policy aspect, not to mention the media, and I'll come to them. In relation to this, what you have fundamentally is this three-tiered aspect. Media vigilantism, and I use this on purpose, the media do not act as the good old journalistic work that they could do, but mostly kind of in a vigilante kind of logic. The terrorism expert pronouncement, the fellows, and they tend to be fellows that show up and tell you exactly what is the latest, sort of the different categories that we have to be on the lookout for. Lone wolf, Mumbai style, this and that, formulas that are meant to give the keys to understanding violence, that are very formulaic, very reductionist, as if one particular event of political violence could be reduced to a certain casting or a certain formula as such. So this has essentially gone along with a certain, of course, condescending interrogation of Islam. When is Islam going to have its long-awaited aggiornamento so that you can essentially engage with that? All of this has produced what I call a non-history of political violence today. The contemporary forms are much more complex. So instead of that, what we can look at is that this entity, ISIS, writ large, ontologically, not ISIS, the group that was occupying simply Mosul and Raqqa and has been supposedly defeated. That's the micro level. That's the journalistic account. It's not really central to how we should understand these things. There will be ups and downs. ISIS might reform under some other form, the freedom fighter liberation movement of whatnot, or the sons of the Islamic State, or this and that. That's the micro-narrative, as I call it. What's really most important is the meaning of this in history. And the meaning of this in history has to do with the fact that we are looking at entities that are not impacted by a single ideology, that are much more transformative, and are not, in fact, constantly functioning in a certain continuity. There's much more hybridity, and I'll come back to this term as such. I would argue, if you want to go deeply into Isis, that I would say this entity has really dwelled into fluidity all the time. It emerges from a mutated scene. This is your self-empowered Islamism, militant Islamism of the 1980s and 1990s. It goes into a further expanded transformation. This is the 2000s, the atomization, the so-called French ISIS, a term of art we have a hard time avoiding. But all of that is fundamentally leading us to a reflection about the terrorism of that group. Now, to be certain, the terrorism of other places, right, the non-Middle Eastern places, those places that are essentially dealt with, is reported. The core representation, however, in the media remains a certain drapery in a well-embroidered, and it's fundamentally about the menace it has to the West. This is the destination of the box. It goes from there to attack here. Everything else is neutralized in that way. An illustration of this, ladies and gentlemen, is the only partially coded reality in the inconsistent use of the also problematic term terrorism by the mainstream media, who resort to it reflexively when the attacks have Muslims associated with them and opt for another terminology when the events of a similar nature have a different type of perpetrator. Attack, shooting, security incident, assault situation. I sat down over the years and I kept seeing every time the assailant was a Muhammad, I could say that I have three Muhammads in my name, and when it wasn't. And literally, you could see how the media were kind of pussyfooting around this, should we use the term? Actually, I had journalists calling me, is this terrorism? I said, well, if it's indiscriminate, attack on an ideological basis, political, well, there you go, check. That's the basic definition. The term is problematic and will disagree forever. Your terrorist is my freedom fighter, etc. And the subjectivity is very problematic, but there's a basic line, the core of it, the indiscriminate targeting of the non-combatant, which gives you a legal entry for the lawyers, by the way, of course, you can function with that. Not the innocent. That's politically loaded, but the non-combatant. Mm. Although, of course, terrorists can also attack military facilities. 9/11 is an example. Pentagon and World Trade Center, for that matter. But they would have a hard time, as I was saying, deciding should we use that. And, of course, constantly the threat is related to that particular entity. In fact, Al-Qaeda, I think, is not defined by its religiosity. This is the main contribution of my work, which is in the minority. I've been cross-fighting with my peer for the past couple of years, who insist that this is all about religion, and I would say, no, it is Al-Qaeda and ISIS are political entities. They say they're religious, and they are Islamists, but that's secondary. That is not really that important. Some of them believe that a lot and want to establish a caliphate. Some do not have a clue about the religion which they are presenting theatrics of. But I, the researcher, should I be limited to that? Should I be only limited to a discourse? Do I hear that and stay with it? Well, that's what she said and that's what it is. Or do I investigate the background, what's coming from? And maybe in so doing, I unearth the politics of it, the military nature of it, the conflict related, the social aspects. And there, yes, I put them there. Baader Meinhof, Red Brigades, Action Directe had a different ideology, extreme left-wing. They were not Islamists, just as these guys are not radical left-wing. And I can go on and on. And the anarchists had no ideology. They wanted to kill the Tsar to essentially have nothing, nihilism, right? But so those ideologies, I place them there, but I really look at Russia in the middle of the 19th century transforming, slowly entering into modernity, rehearsing 1905, 1917. That's what the issue is. It's a society that has a malaise, that is about to go, and soon enough there's a delayed appointment with that. The anarchists are the actors of that malaise, just as Baader Meinhof were the actors of the German malaise 20 years after the Holocaust. Or Red Brigades, the Italian malaise 20 years after fascism. That's the key we have to look at. Not to say these guys want to come here and kill these people. That's the basic level of it. So if you were to do that, you would start looking, as I said, you go away from these generalized expressions that tend to be ahistorical, and that's a problem for the historian and the social scientist generally. and of course they end up being susceptible to what I call here theoretical vacuity. And in history, we do have one of a problem that we need to work more, which is the theorization of history. We have tended to be descriptive or essentially archives-driven, and that's the discipline, but there's also more imaginative ways to think of history, and I'd like to think of in-situ history, as I said, and of theorized history as two ways. As this is taking place, what I call here this ethereal Islamic exegesis, you end up at meetings when the researchers start sort of quoting from the Quran and saying this and that, and you're having a theological conversation when you're supposed to be having a social and political conversation about events, as I said. Underneath that, the fact a bit before, you have something leading up to this period, and that's why I said that where do you draw the line before 9/11? Does it start exactly here or there? Well, in the middle of the 90s, this narrative was already coming in slow motion. And that's why these moments of history that are passing the baton from one moment to the other. It really starts in November 1989. So the wall falls, rather, right? Not the towers, the wall falls. And as a kick moment there, you enter the next sort of 10 years where there's a gap. The Soviet Union is gone, something needs to be replaced, which is literally the title of a New York Times February 1994 article that says the red menace is gone, here's the green one. So it's very interesting, because here the media gives you sort of the zeitgeist. They have seen it, and when you watch the movies at the time, there's a nonsense Schwarzenegger movie at the time, forget the title, where you could clearly see the casting changing from the nasty Russian to now the nasty Middle Easterner taking the place. Sam Huntington gets, in this of course you know, Kaplan's Coming Anarchy, and a forgotten Benjamin Barber, Jihad versus Make World. All of these, by the way, become key works that sell very well and give you the narrative itself. All our top bestsellers and so on. The mindset is there. A generation, a time, gets into a narrative, not overnight. There's a certain preparation. And there's a lesson for us today, in the post-Trumpian era, by the way, as we go into the 2020s. I'm happy to go back to this in the Q&A if you want. I think this is really important when we study social sciences. We tend to be sometimes reactive, looking back. Our world's been transforming since 2016, and we are moving to the consequences of that. In a way, that's exactly what I meant to say through this particular narrative, which are closing and opposing narratives. There's a casting. So we've won. He will admit he was wrong, by the way. In 1998, driving, I heard Fukuyama saying, well, I might have been wrong on that. So this is actually, I'll give him that. That's a bit more complex. He's not calling for the clash of civilization. I knew Sam Huntington at Harvard, and I was a postdoc at the time. He's often misunderstood in what he's saying, in terms of he's not calling for it, although he's very conservative in his approach. But the theme is being used by the neocons to say, aha, we should have a clash of civilization. And the net result is the same. Kaplan, who's an interesting historian, speaks and gives us something very right-wingy about the dangerous places that are coming to take over the world, and they have a destination. His previous book is called The Ends of the World, from Togo to Turkmenistan, as you can see. And by the end of the decade, you have the casting already, and the girl is there with the veil, and we enter what will be kicked into overdrive after 9/11. Instead of that, we're back to our main problem, which is the sort of under-theorization of this discussion. And here, my main argument to you, ladies and gentlemen, that all of these three things, we have homogenized an entity, or two, Al-Qaeda and ISIS, I can discuss the differences. We have put this in an ahistorical line. We don't build this up from the early 20th century, when you see the state-building challenge in the Middle East, in North Africa coming, and the settlement of these countries that are eminently divisive, from Sykes-Picot all the way to Palestine, to decolonization, to the wars of the 70s, to the Lebanon wars, which Ben Laden makes references to in his declaration of war to the United States, two declarations, 96 and 98. All of that is invisibilized, and the initial violence, the first blood, as they called it, is the 9/11 that we go forward with. The problem, as you can see here, is also the last element, which is the depoliticization. This is a paradox. The other name of terrorism is what? Political violence. Most of these books are terrorism and political violence. And yet, what you end up doing is having a conversation which essentially evacuates the politics out of that. You end up having a conversation either about religion, as I said, or simply about individual trajectories, stories, lost youth, these kids that have to be now de-radicalized, that have to be essentially taken out of their violent extremism. The terms appear and they hand it to a whole generation that has to work with that instead of saying, hold on a second, what does it mean? What are these terms? To be radicalized, to be extreme. This is a description of something that is on a continuum. And all of those elements are into policy. So the discussion is straitjacketed, as I said. It, of course, functions with basic elements of Orientalism, which you know about, which is essentially this description of the other who cannot represent himself or herself, that has to be described, that has to be essentially identified because their approach to life, to the world, is static as opposed to something that is changing, and that has to be handed the keys to in terms of the analysis and the understanding of it. So as a net result of that is that, as I write in the italics in the last line, I submit to you, ladies and gentlemen, that the neglected dimension of the whole Islamic State discussion, Al-Qaeda, political policy, is in fact the historical one and the political one. That's where we should start. That's what we should go back and start with. Understand me, that doesn't mean decontextualizing the local stories. We're talking about Islamist movements. We're talking about conflicts that are in the Middle East, for sure. So you take that into account and you build them as one of your parameters. And if some of them are more religious than the others, you also work with that. For instance, you already see a certain modulation. The Islamic State is doing something that Al-Qaeda is not doing. And we tend to look at them with continuity. They're related. One is the product of the other. Again, to be very clear, I'll get to that, but just to give it to you in a moment, the Islamic State is one of the franchises of Al-Qaeda that becomes that entity. But think for a minute about the names. Al-Dawla al-Islamiyya, the Islamic State, right, is different from Al-Qaeda, which means in Arabic, the basis. The basis, literally. So Bin Laden wants to create a basis, and when you look at the early texts, you find that the name used is even more precise. It's Al-Qaeda al-Askariyya, the military base. So there's something very martial about AQ, something very sort of, or technological. The other name that you find in the early text is Sijil al-Qaeda, the registry. So a database and a military base. That's what the fellow wants to do. He wants to build that and throw it. And he's in Afghanistan, and he gets people from Hamburg, and he sends them to Florida, and they get the money from the Emirates, and they train in Tarragona, Spain, and they launch it on the East Coast. Transnationalism, globalization, traveling, crisscrossing. That's already something that we should have been thinking about before ISIS. Now, ISIS comes around and does something different. They want to be a Dawla al-Islamiyya. And it gives you an address, which is the Islamic State in Arabic, Islamic State in Syria and Iraq. So they actually do the opposite, if you think about it, of what Bin Laden wants. He wanted to go, as he called it, from the near to the far enemy, if you're familiar with the text. So the near enemy is the local governments, Mubarak and Saudi Arabia, etc., to the far enemy, which is the US, France, etc. Now, what ISIS does is from the near to the far enemy and back to Mosul, to Raqqa, to be physical, to literally take the bank and the oil and the checkpoints and do that. The moment they re-territorialize, they are negating the transnationality aspect. But they are birthing a different transnationality. Because they're not going. Bin Laden was sending people. So it was embryonic, right? A few people that were trained and sent. Now they're bringing people to them, or rather than inviting people, and they come, as we will see in a moment. So this whole kind of crisscrossing, this movement, is absolutely absent. And so this is why I think it's better understood, as I call, of a puzzle and a hybrid one. At this stage, I think the researcher has to be modest. And I say this because all the time we're seeing these narratives, we saw a lot of these closing narratives, clash of civilization, end of history, jihad versus mid-world, coming anarchy. I think none of these theories will stand the test of time, just like most of the books in my shelf about Al-Qaeda and ISIS, which happen to be all of them, most of them, the bestsellers written by journalists, not scholars, right? Most of these books are very much about giving you a narrative that will not stand, because they are about essentially they're in this, what I would say, declamatory dynamic. That's what it is, and that's how it is. And the next phase is actually the policy piece, and that's how it should be. As opposed to saying, hold on, gee, I don't know, this is changing. It used to be that 5 minutes ago, now it's taking another form, and using the concept we have in social sciences, hybridity is one. You know, the fact that you have something that partakes of two conditions, sort of solid and liquid. Merging them, it gives you something of a hybridity. And thinking beyond the region, contextualizing the region, keeping it in its place, including religion, but essentially seeing these actors as actors that are reacting, transforming, remixing fundamentally. And I use these musical terms on purpose. What ISIS does, it remixes Al-Qaeda and it remixes its violence. It uses that ideology, that vignette, and splashes it. And if you remember the last couple of attacks by ISIS, you had some fellow doing something in Australia or Germany or whatnot, and you wouldn't even know if it was ISIS. He would just claim it, and they would claim it. But was it really, and does it matter? Net result, the sound of it, the visuals of it, is what matters. The fear of it, of course, as you see. So what you have here, the last line is very much the, I call it in the book, the macdonalization of terrorism, which is the dissemination, I should call it by now, the Uberization or the Starbucksization of terrorism, if you follow the logic, but you get the point. The do-it-yourself is actually more accurate. The commodification of something that, where you no longer need a group. Compare that to the 1970s type of violence, where they needed to meet physically, in a safe house, as they call it, plan together, communicate, rehearse, a certain physicality. Now it's all individual. Look at the fellow in New Zealand who's beaming the thing live on Facebook, right? And doing this essentially as almost kind of a happening, if you remember the term from the 60s, kind of going in that way. So what we have ultimately, once you reach that level of dissemination of the legacy of Al-Qaedism, of Al-Qaeda, which is a group, you get into this. It's number two, a certain violence which is purposive. It's not absolutely, you hear this all the time, these people are apocalyptic. No, apocalyptic terrorism is something we know, we've seen, it was millennial. We had an example in 1995 with the Aum sect. It has a certain DNA, the thuggies in the middle century, you have a certain violence associated with that. It's about essentially creating something about the afterworld, right? It's not because of the fact that they want to give their lives that, or they claim a certain religion that it is. This is very much of today. It's very much earthy, very much related to concerns, and very much, therefore, political and social. And as we move into the last phase, this is the difficulty now, it's this kind of physical and symbolic violence that is more and more happening and building up as it is. So what is the entity that gave it, or what was? I left the present on purpose, because I don't want to engage in this. They gone, we've defeated them, this kind of a, you know, kind of Trump, Erdogan, and Mohammed bin Salman kind of a narrative. It's a political narrative. If you're looking at an entity that was at some point and might come back in different things, what you see fundamentally is a combination of the first aspect. First of all, the Al-Qaeda story. And documentarily, we have to establish that. This notion of ISIS is so strong that it has erased ISIS, yes, it is absolutely innovative, but it comes from that entity. And so understanding the history of AQ helps you a lot in identifying the DNA of that entity in terms of its logic, in terms of the transnational aspect. Secondly, of course, where is this coming from? Degenerated conflicts. Abu Ghraib, Bagram, Guantanamo, that's whole violence that gave us all of this and all of the unnamed prisons in Syria and beyond and so on. And that's essentially what we have. The term degeneration is central to this process. We can come back to it. But then, of course, it gets us to my final argument in the book, which is about innovation. And I hesitated a bit about that, because I hate this notion of calling something new for the sake of novelty. The latest, the new, I just critiqued it, right? But it seems to me that there are times where we see acceleration. And here, I think clearly what you saw in the 2010s was really an accelerated fashion, where this entity was able to kind of, you know, bamboozle all of these people into going to the story and producing that, which technically, honestly, could be seen as an original type of political violence, which has to do all of these earlier lines of sort of informing it. colonialism, I should have added, post-colonialism, and of course the unrestrained interventionism of the 90s. We forget the histories of Iraq throughout the 90s, the economic embargo, the wars of Saddam Hussein, all of those stories that are there. One Iraqi historian, Falah Abdel-Jabbar, who passed away recently, he wrote a chapter in a new book that I have, who is a brilliant scholar, actually inspired me in many ways when I was a postdoc. He, in the chapter that he wrote, he speaks about this generation that was born and raised in war. If you think about it, all what Iraq, the Iraqis have known since 1980 is the 8-war year with Iran, then the Gulf War, then the years of the embargo, then the 2003 conflict, then the ISIS years, all the way to now with the militias. It's been really, really kind of almost 30 years of violence. And that's an experience for any person, any child is traumatic being born into that. And we rationalize and we move beyond that. So ISIS, I submit to you, is this hybrid metapuzzle. As I say, I identify in the book these seven layers, which I think give us a sense of how complex this whole thing, because you could see, colleagues, you can see how much of this is simultaneous. You know, we spoke a lot about simultaneity and the layered identity. And it's really not an either or. So, is the entity a descendant of Al-Qaeda? Of course it is. Of course it is. And in many ways it does that. In all the videos, they pay tribute to Bin Laden. They really don't like him as much as a Zarqawi, who's like a nastier, tougher kind of fellow. And the Iraqi one, Bin Laden, was a bit too kind of aristocratic. I call him the aristocratic terrorist. In the book, he was a bit aloof in his strategic political statements. Zarqawi was the guy who started the beheading. So, but nonetheless, they don't actually take any shots at him. Secondly, is it an Iraqi Islamist insurgency? Well, of course, it's born against the Shia control of that country in 2003. Number three, it's the remnants of Saddam Hussein's army. We forget about that. It was. You don't control these cities with a 20-year-old holding an AK-47. Impossible. You need a 50-year-old that has the experience, that knows how to man this, to do that, to control, to have a schedule, to have a system that is organized. That's why they could hold that city for 4 years. It's not something that would happen by any happenstance. And obviously Syria gets into the picture. We go into the larger regionalism, all the way to Egypt with the so-called Sinai entities. And now, and of course the influence on the
Southeast Asia.
It will come back.
Can I continue?
Yes.
All right. Then I'm going to wrap up in the next 5-10 minutes, so we can have at least 20
minutes of conversation, if you don't mind. So, pardon my staccato pace in the next 5 minutes, just to finish this. So, is it the influence on Asia, I'd say, of course, particularly Southeast Asia, all the way to those places? We even have an ISIS Brazilian franchise mentioned during the World Cup in 2014 at the time. And then the last one is the one I want to get to, because this is really the postmodern transformation of the group that works in this kind of, you know, handed way. You move into these different places. And this, I think, to me, this is exactly what ISIS is. It's the combination of these lineages and these temporalities. That's hybridity at its best. You can see it functioning in a way where one leads to the other, and the genealogies remain connected. The post-colonialism is in the DNA, globalization is a vehicle, modernity is bringing us back even to a kind of an anarchic type of violence that you see being born in the West, and to which I'll come back to in a minute. So, how do we get now to the West? Because the talk was about these aller-retour, these back and forth. Well, that's exactly what you end up. Well, there's a deeper history, which is if you project this over there, it's going to come back to you. I call it the boomerang effect. And that's the thing that the West is not looking at, and that's a big taboo, and that's a big elephant in the room. That's colonials. If France goes and rapes Algeria for 132 years, then don't be surprised if you have, you know, after that, trouble or problems or issues, and you can't simply blame it on communitarism and this or that, or integration. That's nonsense. It's a historical reality that has to be dealt with. And euphemistically, what you have today is racism in France that denies its own history when it comes to that. You have people proclaiming to be happy to be with their Islamophobia. Orwell was writing about this, and he was walking the streets in Marrakesh under occupation, and he sees that's not working. And it cannot work because it is happening in that way. But as a result of that, what is being born is this type of cultural influences that go all around colleagues. And you would think that all of these images have nothing in common, but they do. They are all about this traveling, transnational violence that finds itself with its influencing returning soldiers up left, whether it's the violence of the beheadings that you see in the middle, whether it's the return of African-American issues and race issues in the United States, whether it's the terrorist in the city, which over there, the Bane character in the Batman series is absolutely kind of a post-Bin Laden type of terrorist, or whether it's the Sicario type of imagery that you have there, not to mention, of course, the banlieues and the Mission Impossible style, which is reproduced in the ISIS videos. You see them very much behaving in the special forces, or the cultural tension in the middle of the city at any aspect, or the bad, good and bad in the Star Wars series. Here you have a statement, you are with me or against me, if you recall, for any Star Wars fan here, where this is spoken very much in Wuxian terms. With me or against me, Manichean. That Manichean is very much present when he's writing those films in the early 2000s and listening to the State of Union of the Union by Bush at the time, and not to mention all of those other issues, and of course the question of torture itself as such. So this particular aspect is, it's kind of a sampled, again, the music of it. It's the sampling of these questions. ISIS remixes and samples. It creates a collage. It's post-modern violence of that sense that we can only understand by understanding the arts of the early 1960s, when you go back to all of those aspects. Take a look at this. This is an entity. So this is from their communication. In a magazine, they tell you, these are all of the operations that we did last month, right? Sort of a military-style Pentagon reporting. And at the same time, they have this thing which could be an album cover or a concert poster in any Western city that speaks both to that individualized violence and at the same time this kind of military type of demonstrative aspect as such. We end up with this boomerang aspect, which is precisely what I was saying. The tech-savvy aspect, I need not belabor, you have heard about that. The multiplicity, the forward moving, and all of this is also particularly now fueling authoritarian patterns. This is where we are. That's when I said about post 2016, today, all around the world, north and south, Sisi to Trump, Putin to the fellow in Brazil. All of this is completely speaking the same language of that aspect. And as a result of that, you get into the scene where it's normalized outside. We become numb to it. We pass through this scene, and we see that this is the new terrorist, and this is the new interventionist military that has been back and forth. As such, it creates a certain militarization, which is now here. There's a riot in Ferguson, that's what you see. And it creates spaces, of course, in return. That's the language of the actor, and these are the so-called outlaw territories. And it's hardly a metaphor, hardly. There was a Fox News report a year ago that says, that alleged that there were some no-go areas in Paris that the police could not go to. You might have seen this report in terms of that. My invitation to you guys is to have a new thinking about this. To think in a way that is different, that is independent, that is not driven by any authority, to question, starting by everything I said, to question all the time, to recapture critical thinking on these things, to be intellectually disobedient. That's what the scholar does. You're in the world of ideas. This is not a firm. This is not a state. This is about knowledge. You pursue it, the only thing that you have as a requirement is the quality of it, the cogency of it. Everything else is a political conversation over coffee. I like this guy, I don't like him. What is the quality of that? Well, all we've had is narratives about the power of these things. And with that, I thank you very much for your attention.